Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck at the state capitol in Cheyenne.
And I'm Willow Belden in Laramie. For over a decade, the state has struggled with making sure all citizens had access to health care. Much of this had to do with the fact that many Wyoming citizens can't afford health insurance. The Federal Affordable Care Act was supposed to help. A key part of the act would provide states several million dollars to provide Medicaid to the working poor. In Wyoming, that could help between 17,000 and 18,000 people. States have to opt into the program. The Wyoming legislature will consider one bill to do that, but it may have a long road ahead. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
In his annual State of the State message, Governor Matt Mead made it clear that due to problems with the Affordable Care Act, he does not support expanding Medicaid.
Now, I recognize this is a position, but it is far from an answer to addressing the needs of over 17,000 of our citizens who may not have access to health care.
The governor is the first to admit that he doesn't have any ideas to address this population, and apparently few do either. The legislature considered and voted against introduction of two Medicaid-funded bills that were supported by the legislative committee that works on health care issues. One compromise bill did get approved for debate by the Senate, but it remains to be seen if it can get enough support to get to the governor. Chairman of the Senate Health and Labor Committee, Charles Scott, voted against it.
You got to recognize that there is a set of people who simply cannot afford health insurance now. And, you know, we got to be kind of sympathetic to that.
But just not this way.
Yeah, I'm not satisfied with the options we've got at the current moment.
Scott was the main architect of a health care program called Healthy Frontiers, which gave poor people access to doctors. It started under Governor Friedenthal, but ran out of money and was dropped. Scott says health care reforms always have a tough time in Wyoming.
Health care is very complicated. People know it can be very expensive and can wreck your budget if you're not careful. And we've got a block of very conservative legislators who are opposed to government health care programs.
Scott did try a bill this year that would help both the uninsured and those who have seen their insurance rise thanks to the Affordable Care Act. Senate President Tony Ross announced the outcome.
Senate File 108 is screwed. That's failed introduction.
But for those who want Medicaid expansion, this is no laughing matter. Last month, a number of people who can't afford health insurance told legislators heartbreaking stories of health care issues and what the bill would mean to them. One of those committee members was Representative Mary Throne of Cheyenne. The opposition to taking federal money to expand Medicaid mainly centers around the fear that the federal government will not have enough money to sustain the program, which would force the state to either drop it or spend millions of dollars to sustain it. Throne says if the state has to drop it, so be it.
Getting 3 years of health care, good health care, to people who haven't had it, you know, it could change their lives. Even if we can only do it for 3 years, we can get a whole population healthy.
Elaine Harvey, who chairs the House Health and Labor Committee, sits quietly in a Capitol hallway and says kicking people off of Medicaid would be too difficult.
One of the hardest things I've ever done is to take Healthy Frontiers away from people, because we just got people, we gave them hope, and then we took it away from them. And so to start something that we can't finish, I really hesitate to get into, to go there.
But Harvey does think something needs to be done for the uninsured. She favors an approach that would use federal Medicaid money to help people purchase private insurance. Some doctors don't like Medicaid, and Harvey says if people have private insurance, it would mean that medical providers would be more likely to see them.
But if we pass nothing, I think that we're going to have a year of extreme struggles for our small rural providers, both hospitals and doctors. And I think that they're going to have a terrible time trying to make up the difference, because all of the programs that help supplement that uncompensated care are gone.
Dan Perdue is worried about that too. He is the president of the Wyoming Hospital Association.
It's very frustrating. I've been doing this for 22 years, and this is the most frustrating issue that I've dealt with. On paper, it looks like it's a no-brainer that the lawmakers should step up and take the expansion. But I think their reluctance is based on philosophy and not really wanting to have anything to do with Obamacare.
Friday morning, the Senate agreed to support a compromise Medicaid expansion pilot program that would run for 3 years. Sponsored by Laramie Democrat Chris Rothfuss, it brings in some of Harvey's ideas and tries to address other concerns people have had with the federal government's plan. Rothfuss is among those who have strongly advocated for Medicaid expansion and has shared Purdue's frustration.
You have to lead or get out of the way. We've got a lot of people who've just spent a lot of time in the way, as I see it. They're not providing solutions, but they're certainly standing against the suggestions that other legislators are making. And I'm hopeful that something will come out of this session, but the reality is there's a good chance that nothing will be done for these 17,600 people, and that's disappointing.
The Rothfuss bill now heads to a Senate committee for consideration. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
There's a fight brewing in Wyoming over the rights of landowners who don't own the minerals below their properties. In 2005, the legislature passed a split estate law, but now one lawmaker is saying it may be time to revisit the issue in light of changes in drilling technology and intensity. Senator Jim Anderson introduced a bill this week that would increase bonding on split estate properties. Wyoming Public Radio energy reporter Stephanie Joyce joins us to discuss the bill and its implications. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Willow.
So what does this bill do?
Well, the bill itself is actually pretty straightforward. Right now, if companies and landowners can't reach a surface use agreement, the company can petition the Oil and Gas Commission to, quote, bond on. Basically, they post money with the commission to cover the cost of any damages to the property, and then they're allowed to proceed with or without the landowner's consent. And right now, the standard bonding amount is $2,000. This bill would increase the standard bonding amount to $10,000. And landowners would still be able to petition the Oil and Gas Commission for a higher bond if they felt like it was necessary, but the base amount would be higher.
Now, Senator Jim Anderson from Converse County is the main sponsor of the bill. What were his reasons for introducing it?
Well, so Senator Anderson told me he got an earful from his constituents during a meeting in January in Douglas about the shortcomings of the split estate law, and he decided maybe it's time to have another conversation about it, especially in light of some of the new drilling technologies and the increasing intensity of drilling in some areas. Here he is.
Bonding is a kind of a tip of the iceberg. If, in fact, there are other issues that lie deeper, then perhaps this would be an opportunity to discuss those. But if not, then we'll just deal with the bonding issue and let the other lie.
So while bonding is the only thing that's actually on the table this legislative session, we're likely to hear more about this issue in the coming year.
How has the bill been received in the legislature?
The vote to introduce the bill was actually overwhelmingly in support. 25 senators voted to discuss it in committee, and just 5 senators voted against it. But the Petroleum Association of Wyoming is pretty strongly opposed to it, and a similar bill died in the legislature last year. So it will definitely be discussed, but whether or not it passes remains to be seen.
What are the Petroleum Association's objections?
Well, I talked with Bruce Hinchey, the association's executive director, and he basically just said that he doesn't think it's necessary. He couldn't articulate what kind of impact it would have on the association's member companies if the bonding amount were increased, but he said the current system for dealing with landowner complaints, which is petitioning the Oil and Gas Commission to raise the bonding amount, is just fine. Unsurprisingly, Senator Anderson and the landowners I've spoken with disagree. Amber Wilson with the Wyoming Outdoor Council says starting with the higher amount rather than relying on the commission process would be more efficient.
We're always talking about trying to speed things up, and the more you don't set this up for success from the start, the more you're going to bog down the process.
And the other thing is that the Oil and Gas Commission hearing process is very formal. You're expected to show up with your attorney, present exhibits. A lot of landowners say it's a very overwhelming process, and that was another reason that Senator Anderson gave for introducing the bill.
Are there other potential impacts of this legislation other than maybe reducing the need for commission hearings?
There's also a feeling among some landowners and landowner groups that a bigger bond would be a bargaining chip. As Alex Bowler with the Cheyenne Landowners Coalition put it, right now, bonding on for $2,000 might seem like, quote, the path of least resistance to oil and gas companies. You know, that's rather than negotiating a surface use agreement that could total many thousands of dollars. He thinks the $10,000 amount would basically incentivize the companies to negotiate. But that might be a bit of a straw man. Bonding on isn't exactly common practice. There were more than 1,000 wells drilled in Wyoming in 2013, and only 22 of those were bonded on. So presumably for the rest of them, companies were able to negotiate surface use agreements. And I haven't seen any indication that there's an increase in the amount of bonding on that happens. But it does tend to be a very heated topic when it happens. Some of the landowners I've spoken with say it was a bit of a surprise to find out that companies can set up shop with or without their permission, and that the $2,000 amount felt like a bit of a slap in the face. So if nothing else, this bill will be an opportunity to discuss some of those concerns.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing more as the bill moves through the legislature. Thanks so much, Stephanie.
Thank you, Willow.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's energy reporter Stephanie Joyce discussing split estate bonding.
When we come back, we'll talk with the new superintendent of Grand Teton National Park. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. The National Park Service named a new superintendent for Grand Teton National Park this week. David Vella will replace former Superintendent Mary Gibson Scott, who retired last year. Vella is currently an associate director for the Park Service in Washington, D.C. He's worked at parks and historic sites in Texas, Virginia, and Pennsylvania, and directed the Park Service's Southeast region for 4 years. He says one of his goals is to listen to visitor feedback.
But I think the other thing, too, that we also have an interest in doing is to make sure that the park continues to do everything that it can to listen to those that it serves and to engage, frankly, communities and audiences that don't yet know who we are, looking at how can we make ourselves relevant as a park and as an agency to youth and to communities of color around the country.
So how do you do that?
Well, I think we do that through a number of opportunities. One, we tell America's stories. We talk about the contributions that individuals from all different demographics, from different ethnicities, from social backgrounds, financial backgrounds, have played in not only helping to create what is today Grand Teton National Park, but those that have helped to preserve it as well. And so I'm very much looking forward to having conversations when we get there in early March as to how do we go about achieving those interests? How do we go about taking our operations and everything that we do to the next level?
When you're talking about taking things to the next level, are there specific changes that you would like to see in the park that you know about already?
One of the things that I've always enjoyed doing is to listen to the perspectives of those who are involved directly in providing those services, as well as partners and volunteers and stakeholders. What is in the realm of possibility in this park to make this truly a safe, enriching, and an enjoyable experience? How best do we also go about protecting the spectacular place for which we have now been entrusted? What type of science do we need to be looking at? What types of conversations do we need to be having internally and externally in order to preserve and protect these resources for current and future generations? And then based on those conversations and based upon that feedback and input, then develop specific strategies to achieve all of these interests.
So it sounds like you're looking for quite a collaborative relationship with other park employees then.
I have always, yes, absolutely found that to be very helpful, is to have those engaging conversations. How do we get to excellence in this park? And what does that mean to you, ranger, biologist, budget officer? Every different discipline in the park has a very important say, or should have an important say, in how that park is managed and in its short and long-term strategic interest. So I think that collaboration is healthy, it's important, and it's just how we do business.
Now, as you said, you have a long history with the Park Service, but it sounds like you're new to Wyoming, and I'm curious whether you feel you know enough about Wyoming. What do you feel you need to get up to speed on?
Well, that's a very good question, because Wyoming Grand Teton National Park, as my family, we were visiting on our way to Yellowstone, We're country folk, and we're from Southeast Texas, about 60 miles south of Houston, a small agricultural community of, at that time, was around 10 to 12,000 people. And so we, my parents decided to take a trip. And seeing that iconic mountain range for the first time was inspiring as a young boy. So that was my first exposure and experience. We then had a number of trips through the years, but another that is a personal experience was my son, who's going through a law enforcement ranger program through the Intermountain region, actually had his internship there at Grand Tetons National Park 2 years ago. It was also the place where he met his future wife, and he just got married last November, and they're both National Park Service employees, but they met at Grand Teton National Park. And so, although I'm familiar, I've been exposed to the resource and the local community, I'm very much looking forward to be a full-time permanent resident in the weeks to come.
Are there particular issues that, you know, you'll have to deal with as superintendent here in Grand Teton that you maybe haven't had to deal with before that you need to get up to speed on?
It's a good question. I mean, I did have the opportunity when I was a regional director to work very closely with the superintendent from Everglades National Park and Great Smoky Mountains National Park, in addition to 64 other units. And so what you find are some similarities of opportunity, whether it's science issues or interest, whether it's park planning issues and interest. I also have the benefit of knowing personally, consider him a very dear friend, Dan Wink, who's the superintendent of Yellowstone National Park. But so you have some commonalities of issues and interests that superintendents will be addressing, and then you have those that are really just unique and specific to that park. And that's what I look forward to continue to have a dialogue with the staff as to, okay, what are they? What types of things do we need to put on the table sooner rather than later? You know, what types of things do I need to personally engage in to help move these interests forward? And so look forward to having those conversations.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to do so, and I look forward to seeing you in the near future.
Author Ben Killam has studied black bears for decades and has raised orphan bear cubs. His new book is called Out on a Limb, What Black Bears Have Taught Me About Intelligence and Intuition. He joins us now and says his interest in bears came by accident.
I grew up with my father, Lawrence Killam, who was a virologist at the Dartmouth Medical School, and he studied birds as an avocation and wildlife in general. And so I grew up in a household with lots of wild animals around. And when I was two, my dad went on sabbatical to Africa and brought a half-grown leopard into the house, much to my mother's chagrin. But needless to say, we all survived and returned from Africa with two African hornbills and a Nile crocodile that my dad raised in a basement shower till it was about 6 feet long. But we had all kinds of native wildlife, from porcupines to woodchucks and birds and aviaries and hawks and owls and crows and ravens. So based on my childhood experience, I was interested in carnivores. And carnivores present a little different problem to study than birds. My dad prided himself on simple apparatus, a pair of binoculars and a small folding chair, and he and my mother would sit in front of woodpecker nests and document courtship and behavior. But carnivores, as anybody knows who goes into the forest, they disappear rapidly, and they're hard to get any time observing them. And so based on my childhood experience, I decided I could raise an orphan animal loose in the forest, acting as a surrogate mother to it, and document juvenile behavior and use that to understand adult behavior. And I wasn't thinking about bears. The Fish and Game Department, one of the COs, broke departmental policy and brought us an 11-month-old cub that later had to be euthanized, and following that, the Vermont Fish and Wildlife had two orphan cubs that they had heard about what I wanted to do and asked me if I would take. And since that time, we've raised and rehabilitated and returned to the wild over 100 black bear cubs.
You write a lot about Squirty, and maybe that's the bear, I guess, for lack of a better term, closest to you. Tell me about that bear.
Squirty came to me when she was 3 pounds and 7 weeks old, and I raised her and with her siblings loose in the forest, acting as a surrogate mother. When she became adult, she left me and went on her own and established her own home range, and I followed her into the forest. I had a radio collar on her and went in on a radio signal almost daily to see what she was up to, and have followed her since then. She's now 18 years old and will be giving birth to her 10th set of cubs in the wild.
Well, obviously, and this is what we want to talk about, and this is what you wrote about, and again, we're talking with Ben Killam. He wrote Out on the Limb, What Black Bears Have Taught Me About Intelligence and Intuition. You've obviously learned a lot from bears. I this is such an open-ended question, I'm afraid to ask it, but I just want to throw this out there. What have you learned about bears that maybe a lot of us don't know? For instance, a lot of us that go into the forest are worried about encountering one. Should we be afraid?
Well, what I've learned is bears are just another animal, and if you can understand their behavior and learn how they communicate, you can do quite well with them in the forest, and you don't have to be fearful of them. Bears are a lot like us, and they communicate with both emotion and intention. So if you meet a female bear on a trail and she false charges, and that means she rushes at you and expels a big blast of air, it'll scare you to death. But she just wants to delay confrontation long enough for communication to take place. And if you're working at a restaurant or and carrying a pail of food scraps out to a dumpster and a bear false charges you, he simply wants you to drop the pail of food scraps before you put them in the dumpster. So we can understand these animals, and that's what I hope will help people deal with these animals as they encounter them in the forest.
Is there something that about bears that even surprised you? I mean, you'd been around wild animals your whole life. I'm curious what maybe you got from them that maybe you didn't expect.
Well, I think one of the biggest surprises was that while they would bite to punish, which is cubs are like human children. They use pain and pleasure to manipulate us to make sure we took care of them properly. But they would also reconcile. And that reconciliation was a big surprise. I don't get it with my dog, and I don't get the punishment with my dog. He kind of takes everything. But the bears, they bite you if you're not doing things correctly, and then they make up, and they don't hold grudges.
Out on a Limb is the name of the book, What Black Bears Have Taught Me About Intelligence and Intuition. Ben Killam is the author. A pleasure having you on our program. Very interesting discussion. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll take a closer look at the dispute over boundaries and jurisdiction on the Wind River Reservation, and we'll talk with the longtime head of the Wyoming Mining Association, who's retiring this spring. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck at the State Capitol in Cheyenne.
And I'm Willow Belden in Laramie. The governments of Riverton, Fremont County, the state, and the two tribes who share the Wind River Indian Reservation are arguing again over the reservation's borders. An Environmental Protection Agency decision last December drew the borders to include Riverton as tribal land, something Wyoming contests. The tribe saw the move as righting a historical wrong, but Riverton and the state say the EPA didn't have the jurisdiction to make that call. But perhaps one question not being asked is, why are we still fighting over reservation borders in 2014? Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Joroff takes a look.
First, a little background. In 1905, Congress opened up a piece of the Wind River Indian Reservation to white settlement. Today, the state and tribes are disputing whether the Act of 1905 just allowed white settlers to live there, or if the land was actually taken away from the Indians. That's still unresolved. But some people think that shouldn't stop attempts to resolve other, long-standing issues. Enter
John Vincent, and I'm a lawyer here in Riverton, Wyoming.
He was also mayor of Riverton from 2003 to 2011.
Early on, really from the outset of my time as mayor, I thought it was exceedingly important that the city of Riverton and our residents tried to find a way to live in harmony with our brothers and sisters on the reservation.
In 2008, Vincent worked with leaders from both the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes to draft an agreement that said tribes and the city would mediate rather than litigate on different issues.
In other words, to meet and confer and act with goodwill toward each other to resolve differences.
The idea was to write up memorandums of understanding, or MOUs, after that initial agreement that would outline how exactly the tribes and the city would negotiate in different situations. For example, law enforcement and taxes. He says they would have addressed the very things that are causing concerns and strong words today regarding the EPA ruling. But Vincent says a small but very vocal group of people in Riverton convinced others that the agreements were not a good idea.
It reached such a point that there were physical attacks made on tribal councilmen who came to our city meetings by white people who attended.
Vincent says he was jumped too.
What then happened was the tribes wrote a letter that withdrew these agreements on the night there was supposed to be a vote. Prior to the time there was a vote, because they were afraid what would happen to me.
And that was it. The MOUs never happened. He says when he started writing the agreements in 2008, the state already had a bad track record of working with the tribes. There was, for example, a drawn-out, expensive lawsuit over water rights in the Bighorn water system that went to the Supreme Court. There was a lawsuit over voting in Fremont County. There was a lawsuit over gaming. Vincent says not only did the suit strain relations between the state and tribes, but the state lost in all those cases. By not engaging with the tribes, he says, the state ended up in a worse position than they could have.
Our refusal, our stubbornness, our, I don't know what you call it, arrogance, I guess, led to that result.
Other states and tribes have dealt with similar issues. Kathy Ling is a city commissioner in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. Around the time Vincent was trying to write up his agreements, Mount Pleasant and the Saginaw Chippewa tribe were locking horns on jurisdictional issues almost identical to those sparked by the EPA decision. But tribal and non-tribal governments there negotiated.
I think the key was both felt they could either win or lose if it went to court, and that we were better off if we controlled our own fate.
The negotiations led to mutually agreeable arrangements about jurisdiction for law enforcement, about tax issues, and a host of other things. Ling says the agreements have made things more workable for everyone involved and improved the relationship between governments long term. She says the negotiating process was controversial in Mount Pleasant also, but that faded.
Part of that is because the governor's office, at the state level, the governor at the time, Jennifer Granholm, really wanted a negotiated settlement.
But for Wyoming Governor Matt Mead, negotiating hasn't been a priority. The various governmental entities have not met since EPA issued its decision. Mead says it was up to the EPA to have initiated some sort of negotiation before making its decision.
But in fairness, had they come to me and said, hey, we want to negotiate this, my response would be, I don't believe that you, as a regulatory agency, have the authority to redefine the state boundaries, number one. Number two, in doing that, you'll go against history, you'll go against what I believe a court precedent is, and you'll create issues.
Mead says he doesn't have any problems with the tribes, and indeed the state does work with the tribes on some issues. Mead says it's the EPA that makes him mad and blames them for the confusing process. But the tribes still feel slighted by the local and state government's swift negative reactions to the EPA's decision. Here's Eastern Shoshone Business Council Chairman Darwin St. Clair Jr.
We want things to go good for everybody, and not just for us, but for everyone, and for people to be understanding of what's going on.
He says there's a history lesson here. To him, the tribes haven't exactly gotten a fair deal from white governments in the past. And in 2014, tribes have more power and information to make sure that doesn't happen again.
When people sometimes talk about history, and they always say history repeats itself, history only repeats itself if you make the same decision.
That could be a good lesson for the state, too. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
The EPA announced this week that it's putting its decision on hold on the disputed sections of land. Wyoming has now filed an appeal to EPA's decision in the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Marion Loomis has been with the Wyoming Mining Association, one of the state's most influential interest groups, for almost 40 years. Earlier this week, he announced that he would be retiring that post in April. Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce caught up with him to discuss his career and what the future holds for the state's mining industry.
Back when you started with the Wyoming Mining Association in the 70s, clearly Powder River Basin coal was not as important as it is today. Would you ever have anticipated that coal would be as important as it is today?
Well, we knew it was going to be important. In 1973, there was an Arab oil embargo, which anybody my age remembers well. And as a result of that, the country was decided that we would become energy independent. And part of that process would be to build coal gasification plants, coal liquefaction plants, power plants in Wyoming and across the United States. So we knew that coal was going to be a big deal, but we never anticipated, I don't think, the level of production or the level of efficiency that the coal mines achieved with technology and equipment and use of explosives that we're doing today. So that part of it has been astonishing to me, but the fact that we got into the coal business in the 70s is not.
You're leaving at a bit of an interesting time. There's a lot of changes happening in the coal industry right now. And what do you think the biggest challenges that your successor is going to face are when it comes to coal?
The biggest issue is dealing with the Environmental Protection Agency and the rules that are coming out. You know, we made such tremendous strides in reducing emission levels. We've increased coal production about 170% in this country in the last 20 years and reduced pollutants by over 85%. You know, we started with particulates, and now we've got taking most of all the particulates out, then the sulfur dioxide, and we're getting the sulfur dioxide out. We're getting the nitrogen oxides out. Now we're working on mercury, and it wasn't too many years ago that we didn't think we could get the mercury out of Wyoming coal. But they've developed new technologies, and now the newer plants have mercury controls on them, and they're getting the mercury out. Given time, I think we could reduce the carbon dioxide emissions as well. But coal is going to be here for a long time, and while we've seen reductions in production for the last two or three years, I think we might actually see an increase this year in Wyoming production. The real key is going to be what happens with this new carbon dioxide standard.
We talked about how hard it was in the 70s to predict that Powder River Basin coal would be as important today as it is. How well do you think we can predict what's going to be happening 40 years down the line with Powder River Basin coal?
I can't predict what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, we may find totally new energy supplies. I mean, maybe we'll have hydrogen by then. You know, if we had a combination of solar and wind to do the electrolysis to produce hydrogen, maybe hydrogen will be a source of supply. That we may find other sources of energy 40 years down the road. But I think coal is going to continue to be a major source of energy for this country. We just have so much of it, and it's efficient, it's reliable, and it's relatively inexpensive compared to almost any of the other energy sources. So I think there's going to continue to be people like our School of Energy Resources and other research institutions that look at how can we take this resource that we have so much of and turn it into usable fuel, whether that's through gasification and liquefaction, whether it's through some other way to utilize the coal resource. I think we will continue to use coal.
There's another industry in Wyoming that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, which is the rare earth elements mining industry. I'd be interested to hear what you think about its prospects for the future and whether you think Wyoming is going to be a producer of rare earth minerals.
Well, I definitely think we're going to be a producer of rare earth minerals. It's going to be a really small operation compared to the big coal mines or the Trona operations, but certainly, if we have more hybrids, the wind energy continues to go, there's going to be a demand for rare earth elements. Electric cars are going to require a lot of rare earth elements. And if the electric cars take off, there's going to be real demand there. While you don't need a whole lot of rare earth elements in many of these new high-tech things, you do need them. You have to have it. So that's pretty exciting for Wyoming.
Do you have plans to continue working with the industry after your retirement?
I don't have any plans right now. Primarily, my wife and I'd like to do some more traveling, and I need to get into the mountains more. And I have plans to play a lot of golf. I want to play every golf course in the state of Wyoming, and I'm about three short, so I've got to get out and get those golf courses played. So.
I really appreciate you speaking with me.
You bet. Glad to do it.
When we come back, we'll visit with a master pianist who's just 12 years old. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. James Wilson has been playing the piano since he was 3 years old. His father, Matt, remembers a phone call from his son's first piano teacher.
We've got a problem. The problem is your three-year-old is better than your five-year-old and is better than your seven-year-old and is chasing at the heels of your 11-year-old. And I don't want to create chaos in the home. What should I do?
Well, the family embraced James's talent. In 2009, the Wilsons moved to Laramie so James could study with Dr. Teresa Bogart at the University of Wyoming. James is now 12. He just got back from an international competition in Paris. He still remembers his first competition in Tennessee when he was just 5 years old. Despite being the youngest pianist there, he plays third in the finals. But that's not all he remembers. James Wilson sat down with Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer to talk about music and what's on every 12-year-old boy's mind, food.
We were able to eat a lot of really awesome food, like a mud pie. That's what was one of the things that we had in Tennessee.
So it's not just about the music. It's also about the pie.
Well, my parents usually have me adapt to different places. It's an experience that you have to really learn from.
So tell me about your trip to Paris.
Paris was a lot of fun, and the competition was very, very good. Unfortunately, I was not able to win, but I was able to experience how people in Europe and others who go to conservatories, how they were able to play and how high of a competition and level it was.
What's your goal when you play music? Is it to play better than other people, or are you looking for something else?
I look for playing the best of my ability. Instead of trying to beat the other people, just trying to show the judges who you are as a person and your personality through the music. I can't say it any better, but Beethoven used to say, this is a quote-unquote, he said, music speaks what cannot be spoken. Soothes the mind and gives it rest, heals the heart and makes it whole, flows from heaven to the soul.
And you feel like that's true?
Yes, very true.
Now, you said that when you were in Tennessee, you had great pie. Tell me a little bit about in Paris, some of the experiences you had.
We had a host family because there were no hotels near the competition. And so we had everyday cheese. And each day we would add on different kinds of cheese. I ate rabbit even though I got really mad at myself for eating it. And I also had duck liver, which I didn't really like the thought of. The rabbit tasted really good. The duck liver I didn't really like. The cheese was really amazing, and all of their food actually tasted really, really good.
So it sounds like when you travel, food's a big part of it.
Well, yes. In the U.S., I sometimes have, like, these places that I have to go to before my competitions because for some reason I always think they're my lucky charms. And so, like, I go to Panda Express 2 days before, and then the day before, the night before, I go to Buffalo Wild Wings. And then it ends up being a really good day the next, but of course, the food's not always the reason why you play well, so.
So what else do you do to prepare?
The day before, I always go to a piano and I practice for a little while. And then after that, I go to somewhere fun, like a nickel arcade or something like that.
And just kind of forget all about it.
But of course, my mom always wants me to make sure that I don't play too much so that I don't get out of the zone.
So what does it feel like when you're in the zone?
It feels quite amazing. It feels like your heart's not pumping. You don't have any anticipation or anything. You just feel like you feel the music. You're inside of the music, and you're there inside of the story of the music.
Feel like you get to tell the story, or is the composer the one who tells the story?
The composer used to tell the story until he died, or she died. So I have a different story or a different type of story, and piano is about how you play the piece, not the technique, but what you think the piece should sound like. And so if it should sound really joyful or not. And that's how I tell the story in the different pieces.
You're 12 now.
Yes.
What grade are you in?
Seventh.
Seventh grade, okay. What are your dreams for the future? Where do you want the piano to take you?
I want my piano career to take me to the end of the line. Because, first of all, I want to be able to be like my teacher. So I want to be able to travel the world and be able to do that for a living. But at the same time, I want to follow my teacher's footsteps in becoming a professor and a teacher. And so that's where I want piano to take me.
Thanks so much, James.
Yep, you're welcome.
Time now for Wyoming Stories. This is a project that records Wyoming residents interviewing their friends and loved ones. This week, we'll meet Bill Briggs from Jackson Hole. He worked as a climbing and ski guide for many years, and in 1971, he was the first person ever to descend the Grand Teton on skis. His friend, Spark M., asks him to describe the experience.
Did you come up with this idea yourself to ski the Grand?
It was just pushed along. And you're in an environment in with personalities that were encouraging. It was sort of expected. I'd like to tell the story of being in the Shady Lady Bar at Snow King, and we're sitting around the table, and I'm saying the Grand could be skied, and they said, no, it's impossible. Couldn't be done, so I had to do it. That was the final straw. The next thing was to go do it. So basically, I was alone, which is okay. I've only got myself to take care of here. And doing something that's that far out, I was happy to do by myself.
So what happened? You're on the top of the mountain.
Oh, on top?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, the problems that you have. In those days, you didn't have plastic straps to hold on crampons. They were leather. You get to the top of the mountain, you have to take the crampons off. Now, getting the right one off, I have to do behind my back. Normally, you can just reach down, but I can't reach the foot to the fused hip. So I have to do this behind my back, and I find out the strap is frozen. Now, you have to warm up the hand and then unfreeze the strap and go back and forth that way half a dozen times, finally you get the strap off. Now you get the crampons off and you're on a crusted surface. And you can put on the downhill ski. Now when you go to put on the uphill ski and you lean over and there is no flat ground, all you have is this rounded egg shape at the top of the mountain. You go down to put the other ski on, and the one that you're standing on starts to go forward around the egg. To get the second ski on was a real challenge. I mean, that's really difficult. Then skiing down, that's easy. Very tight in between the rocks off the summit. It's very narrow going on a hard crust and just wonderful, fun skiing. I must say, I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed fitting the skis through on that. I know I'm going to break through the crust at some point, who knows when. And when the skis do break through, I fall over downhill. And you roll over and get right back up again. It's a nonstop action, which I'm used to doing. No problem. Zip right back up. And ski down Petzold Ridge, and it's narrowing. It's got a cornice on one side and rocks on the other. The snow is perfect. Skis are perfect. I mean, the whole thing is just, you know, how could it be any better? And then you go out on the east face. The east face, I know, is going to slide. The thing is to pick the exact place where the slide will break off. I had spotted just where I wanted to go on the way up, so it was a matter of cutting across and making sure it would slide. So I cut across, and boy, it slid just perfect. And you just back up a little and ski down where it had slid off. So all the snow had gone by the other guys down below waiting, and they figured I was in that. When I go down, I do the final bit through that narrow, steep, narrower than my skis were long. So you didn't have much room. Skiing through, and the tails of skis hit on a right-hand turn, hit the rocks. No great problem, but that was a really tricky thing to pull off. Skiing through there, I don't know many, if anybody, has since done it. They all rappel that. I didn't have a rope. I couldn't rappel it. I had to ski it. So ski down, pull up behind the other guys, and they weren't even looking. I pull up, where did you come from? The rest of the way down, wonderful adventure. Good corn snow, but a pretty bad runnel. Skiing across the runnel, I started a bit of a slide, and the other guys are down below me, so you roll over and put one ski tip in, bury it in the slide, and the slide stops, and that stops the avalanche from going.
So what happened when you were walking down the end of this?
Oh, on the trail down. Yeah, you get down on the trail, you came across a couple that were coming up, and yeah, they asked, where have you, you know, you've been skiing, yeah, so where did you ski up on the Grand Teton, for how high up from the top, how many times? You know, just once. Oh, that's too bad.
So, Bill, when you got back to the bar, the shady lady or wherever, then what?
No one would believe it. No one would believe it that night. So the next day I go up to the airport and I could see the tracks from the airport. Without binoculars, I could see tracks up there. So I called up Ginny Heidi Cooper at the guide. And she said, stay right there and I'll come up and we'll go take a picture of it. And the picture has been a wonderful thing.
It's very elegant.
Yeah.
That was Bill Briggs talking with his friend Spark M. Briggs was the first person ever to ski down the Grand Teton. This piece was recorded as part of Wyoming Stories and was produced by Micah Schweitzer and Cordelia Zars.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us on Twitter.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.